everyone, welcome back for another deep dive. Today, we're traveling back in time to explore the fascinating world of archaeology.
A world full of ancient mysteries, lost cities, and intriguing artifacts.
Exactly. And we're going to focus on how archaeology intersects with biblical studies, uncovering clues that shed light on the stories and events of the Bible.
It's like a detective story, piecing together fragments of the past to understand a much larger narrative.
Absolutely. Our guide for this journey is Dr. Elaine Phillips, a renowned scholar in biblical studies. We're going to be diving into excerpts from one of her lectures, which is packed with insights, photographs, and even some hot topics.
Oh, yes. Dr. Phillips doesn't shy away from the debates. She brings up some intriguing questions that are still hotly contested among archaeologists today.
Exactly. So get ready for some aha moments as we explore the world of biblical archaeology. But before we get into the nitty-gritty, let's address the big question. Can archaeology actually help us understand the Bible?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And to answer it, we need to start with the basics.
Okay, let's lay the groundwork. What are some of the fundamental concepts we need to grasp before we start digging into those ancient ruins?
Well, one of the most important concepts in biblical archaeology is the idea of tells. Have you ever heard of them?
I have. They're those mound-like hills that you see dotting the landscape in the Middle East.
You got it. Imagine a flat-topped hill with gently sloping sides, almost begging to be excavated. That's your classic tell, and it's essentially a time capsule of history.
So it's not just a random hill, it's actually layers upon layers of ancient settlements, each stratum representing a different time period.
Exactly, like a giant layer cake of history. Each layer holds clues to a different era, with the oldest layers at the bottom and the most recent at the top.
Wow, that's an amazing visual. So how do these tells help us understand the Bible?
Well, many of the sites mentioned in the Bible are located on or near these tells.
Mm.
By excavating them, archaeologists can uncover physical evidence that relates to biblical events, people, and cultures.
It's like connecting the dots between the biblical narrative and the archaeological record.
Precisely. For instance, Dr. Phillips mentions tells like Dothan and Beersheba, which were strategically important in biblical times.
Right. I remember learning about those places in Sunday school. Weren't they located on major trade routes?
Exactly. These locations were vital crossroads, making them important centers of trade, culture, and often, unfortunately, conflict as well. Their placement on these routes gives us insights into ancient travel patterns and the strategic importance of certain areas.
And speaking of Beersheba, Dr. Phillips shows us an early photograph revealing rooms built incredibly close to the city wall.
Oh, yes. I remember that photo. It's quite striking.
Can you imagine living that close to the city's defenses? It must have been a life constantly on edge.
It really highlights the realities of ancient life, the constant threat of invasion, and the need for fortified settlements. It makes you appreciate the security we often take for granted today.
Absolutely. So we've got these tells, these incredible time capsules of history. But how do archaeologists make sense of the different layers and put them in chronological order?
That's where archaeological dating techniques come in. They use a variety of methods, like carbon dating and analyzing pottery styles, to determine the age of the different layers. And then they use these dates to create a timeline, which they can then compare to biblical events.
So it's like a giant puzzle, fitting together pieces of evidence from both archaeology and the Bible.
You got it. And to make things a bit more organized, archaeologists use specific chronological periods, mainly the Bronze and Iron Ages.
Those terms sound familiar. I remember learning about them in history class.
They're commonly used to categorize different phases of ancient history based on the types of tools and technologies prevalent during those times. The Bronze Age, for example, is characterized by the use of bronze tools and weapons, while the Iron Age saw the introduction of iron.
And these periods align with biblical events, right? Like the Exodus is often associated with the late Bronze Age.
Exactly. And what's fascinating is that some scholars, particularly in biblical archaeology, propose alternative names for these periods, reflecting the specific cultural contexts of the ancient Near East. For example, they might refer to the late Bronze Age as the late Canaanite period.
Ah, so it's not just about the materials used, but also about recognizing the unique cultural developments of the region.
Precisely. And it's important to keep in mind that there's ongoing debate and discussion within the field. New discoveries and interpretations can always lead to revisions and refinements of these chronological frameworks.
That's a good reminder that archaeology is a constantly evolving field, with new insights emerging all the time. But let's get back to those tells for a moment. We've talked about the layers and the time periods, but what about all the stuff they dig up? I mean, what kinds of things do they actually find in these ancient ruins?
Oh, they find all sorts of amazing things. From monumental structures like temples and palaces to everyday objects like pottery shards, tools, and even food remains.
It's like a treasure trove of ancient life. But how do they make sense of all these artifacts? What can a broken piece of pottery really tell us about the past?
More than you might think. By carefully analyzing these artifacts, archaeologists can reconstruct daily life, trace cultural shifts, and even understand political power dynamics. Take, for example, a simple oil lamp.
Okay, an oil lamp. What could that possibly reveal?
Well, for starters, it tells us about ancient lighting technology and how people illuminated their homes. But it can also reveal trade routes based on the materials used to make it. And depending on its craftsmanship and decoration, it might even hint at the social status of the people who owned it.
Wow, so every artifact has a story to tell, even the seemingly mundane ones.
Exactly. And Dr. Phillips gives some other captivating examples, like burial chambers from the Second Temple period with their intricate ossuaries, and even Roman milestones with inscriptions that tell us about ancient road systems.
Those inscriptions are like little voices from the past, aren't they?
They really are. And it's incredible to think we can hold these tangible pieces of history in our hands, objects that were touched and used by people who lived centuries ago.
It's like we're reaching across time and connecting with those ancient cultures in a very real way. And it's not just about the big monumental structures.
Right. The focus of archaeology has shifted in recent years. It used to be all about empires and rulers, but now there's a growing emphasis on understanding the daily lives of everyday people.
That's so interesting. So it's less about kings and queens and more about the ordinary folks who made up these ancient societies.
Precisely. Dr. Phillips, for example, describes a water tunnel used by the inhabitants of ancient Megiddo. This tunnel allowed them to secretly access their spring during a siege.
Wait, seriously? That's amazing. They were basically tapping into their own hidden water source to survive. That's incredible ingenuity. It shows just how resilient and resourceful these people were.
Exactly. And it gives us a glimpse into their daily lives, the challenges they faced, and the solutions they devised.
Okay, so we've got these tells, these time capsules of history. We've got archaeologists analyzing artifacts and uncovering the daily lives of ancient people. But how does all this tie into the Bible?
That's where things get really interesting. It leads us to another debate that Dr. Phillips discusses, the one about biblical archaeology versus Syro-Palestinian archaeology.
Okay, those terms sound a bit academic. Can you break it down for us? What's the core of this debate?
The fundamental question is whether the Bible should be used as a guide for interpreting archaeological finds.
That's a tricky one. So should we be looking for evidence that specifically supports the biblical narrative, or should we be aiming for a broader understanding of the ancient world?
That's the crux of the debate. Should we prioritize a specifically biblical lens or aim for a broader, more culturally inclusive understanding? Some argue that the Bible is a reliable historical source, and that archaeology should be used to illuminate its stories and events.
So they're essentially using archaeology to prove the Bible, right?
Well, it's not quite that simple. It's more about seeing archaeology and the Bible as complementary sources of information that can enrich our understanding of each other.
Okay, so that's one side of the debate. What about the other side? What do the Syro-Palestinian archaeologists believe?
They argue that we should approach the archaeological record with a more neutral lens, focusing on the broader cultural and historical context of the ancient Near East, rather than solely through a biblical perspective.
So they're saying we should treat the Bible as just one source among many and not necessarily prioritize it above other ancient texts or archaeological evidence.
Exactly. They're advocating for a more objective and inclusive approach, one that considers the wider cultural tapestry of the region.
Okay, that makes sense. But I have to admit, I'm still drawn to the idea of using archaeology to connect with the Bible in a tangible way.
Oh, absolutely. And there's no denying that those connections can be incredibly powerful and insightful. And that brings us to another hot topic that Dr. Phillips addresses, historical minimalism.
Now, that's a term I've heard thrown around quite a bit, often with a lot of controversy surrounding it.
It is a controversial school of thought. Historical minimalism questions the historical accuracy of certain biblical narratives, particularly the grand accounts of the United Monarchy under David and Solomon.
So they're basically saying that the Bible might have exaggerated or even invented some of those stories, like maybe David and Solomon weren't as powerful or influential as the Bible portrays them.
That's essentially their argument. They suggest that there's a lack of archaeological evidence to support the grandeur of the Davidic Solomonic era as depicted in the Bible.
Okay, so they're looking for physical proof, for tangible evidence that corroborates the biblical narrative. But what if that evidence hasn't been found yet?
That's a key point. Absence of evidence isn't necessarily evidence of absence. Just because we haven't found something yet doesn't mean it never existed.
That's true. But I'm curious, what specifically do the minimalists point to as evidence for their claims?
Well, they often highlight the lack of monumental structures from the 10th century BCE that can be definitively attributed to David or Solomon.
So no grand palaces, no imposing temples, no massive fortifications that scream, King David was here.
Exactly. They argue that if David and Solomon were truly the powerful rulers described in the Bible, we should find more archaeological evidence of their reign. They suggest that Jerusalem, for example, was likely a relatively minor settlement during that period, not the grand capital city depicted in the biblical account.
Wow, that's a pretty bold claim. So they're basically saying that the Bible inflated the significance of David and Solomon and their kingdom.
That's the gist of their argument.
Hmm.
And they suggest that much of the biblical narrative, particularly those grand historical accounts, may have been written or rewritten centuries later during the Persian period, to serve specific political and ideological purposes.
So it's like they're saying the Bible is more of a work of propaganda than an accurate historical record. But wait, didn't they find something that totally contradicts this view? Something that suggests David was a real historical figure?
You're talking about the Tel Dan inscription, right?
The one that sent shockwaves through the world of biblical archaeology? That's the one. What's so special about this inscription, and how does it challenge the minimalist perspective?
This inscription, discovered in 1993 at the site of Tel Dan, is a fragmentary stele, or inscribed stone, that clearly mentions the House of David.
Hold on, House of David, as in King David, the David from the Bible.
The very same. And the inscription dates back to the 9th century BCE, not long after the time of David and Solomon.
So it's like a voice from the past, directly contradicting the minimalist claim that David was a fictional figure or that his kingdom was insignificant.
Exactly. The Tel Dan inscription is a game changer because it provides extra biblical evidence from a source outside the Bible that confirms the existence of a Davidic dynasty.
Wow. It's like history is speaking back to us, challenging our assumptions and revealing new layers of understanding. But hold on a second. If this inscription is so important, why don't we hear more about it? Why isn't it more widely known?
Well, it's certainly not ignored in scholarly circles. But you're right. It hasn't received the same level of popular attention as some other archaeological discoveries.
Mm.
And there are a couple of reasons for that. Firstly, it's a fragmentary inscription, meaning it's not a complete text. We only have a few pieces of the original stele.
Ah, so it's like a puzzle with some pieces missing.
Exactly. And that makes it more challenging to interpret and understand the full context of the inscription. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, the inscription was found reused in a later structure.
What do you mean by reused?
It means that the original stele was broken up and its pieces were used as building material in a later wall. It was essentially recycled. And that actually helps authenticate the inscription.
How so?
Because it means that it couldn't have been a modern forgery. If someone had tried to create a fake inscription, they wouldn't have deliberately broken it up and hidden it in a wall.
Ah, that makes sense. It's like a built-in security measure against fraud. So the Tel Dan inscription, despite its fragmentary nature and its unusual discovery context, stands as a powerful testament to the historicity of David and his dynasty.
It does. And it's not the only challenge to the minimalist perspective. Dr. Phillips highlights other archaeological discoveries that cast doubt on their claims. For instance, they downplay the significance of Jerusalem during the 10th century BCE, but we have ancient texts from outside the Bible, like the Amarna letters, that mention Jerusalem as a prominent city during that same time period.
So it's not just the Bible that portrays Jerusalem as a major center.
Exactly. The Amarna letters, a collection of diplomatic correspondence between Egyptian pharaohs and their vassals in Canaan, paint a picture of Jerusalem as a significant city with its own ruler. And they date back to the 14th century BCE, well before the supposed invention of the biblical narrative during the Persian period.
It seems like the evidence is piling up against the minimalist view. They're claiming that Jerusalem was just a tiny village back then, but these extra-biblical sources suggest otherwise.
And there's more. Dr. Phillips also discusses the discovery of a monumental structure in the city of David, dating back to the 10th century BCE. This structure, known as the Large Stone Structure, is believed to have been part of David's palace complex.
Hold on. So not only was Jerusalem a significant city, but it also housed a grand royal structure during David's reign. That doesn't sound very minimalist to me.
It does make you wonder, doesn't it? And let's not forget Kirbet Kayafa, that large fortified city we mentioned earlier, located southwest of Jerusalem. It dates back to around 1000 BCE, which means it was built during David's time.
Ah, yes. Kirbet Kayafa. That's the site with the massive wall and two gates, right? What's so significant about this discovery?
Well, its location and the scale of its fortifications suggest a strong centralized government, which challenges the minimalist claim of a weak and decentralized kingdom during David's reign. It also indicates a level of sophistication in urban planning and military defense that doesn't align with the minimalist view of a relatively insignificant settlement.
Wow, the evidence really seems to be stacking up against their claims. It's like they're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole.
That's a great analogy. And it's important to remember that archaeology is an ongoing process. New discoveries can always change our understanding of the past, and there's still so much more to uncover. But it's exciting to see how these archaeological finds are challenging long-held assumptions and shedding new light on the biblical world.
It's like a giant puzzle, and with each new discovery, we're getting closer to completing the picture.
Exactly. And that's what makes archaeology so fascinating. It's a constant journey of discovery, and we never know what amazing revelations await us just beneath the surface.
Speaking of revelations, Dr. Phillips goes beyond these grand narratives and delves into the everyday lives of people in ancient Israel. I'm really curious to hear what she has to say about that.
Oh, it's truly fascinating. She provides a captivating glimpse into their world, revealing the ingenuity, resilience, and even the humor of these ancient communities.
Okay, I'm definitely intrigued. Tell me more about what we can expect.
Well, one of the things Dr. Phillips highlights is the importance of water in ancient Israel.
Water. I mean, water is essential for life, but how does it tie into the story of ancient Israel?
Well, for starters, water was essential for survival in a region that often experienced drought. But it was also a source of community life, ritual practices, and even political conflict. Think about it. Control of water sources would have been crucial for any society, especially in the ancient world.
So it's not just about quenching thirst. It's about power, control, and the very survival of communities.
Precisely. And Dr. Phillips illustrates her point with examples of ancient water systems, from the sophisticated tunnels of Megiddo and Gibeon to the grand aqueducts of Roman Caesarea.
I remember those photos from her lecture. That incredible stepped tunnel leading down to the spring at Gibeon was just breathtaking.
Isn't it amazing? It's a testament to the ingenuity and resourcefulness of these ancient people, their ability to adapt to challenging environments and create sustainable solutions for their communities.
It's mind-blowing to think about the engineering skills and the sheer determination that must have taken to construct these water systems. It really puts our modern conveniences into perspective.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And it shows that these ancient communities were far from primitive. They were innovative, resourceful, and incredibly adept at harnessing the resources of their environment.
Okay, so we've got water, this essential element that shaped the lives of ancient Israelites. What other everyday aspects of their culture does Dr. Phillips explore?
Well, she also delves into the fascinating world of pottery.
Pottery? Really? I mean, it's just pots and jars, right? What's so fascinating about that?
Oh, it's much more than just pots and jars. Pottery is like a fingerprint of ancient cultures. It can tell us so much about their technology, their artistic styles, their trade networks, and even their daily routines.
Wait, so you're telling me that even broken pottery can tell us something about the past?
Exactly. Each piece of pottery, each shard, is a potential clue that can help us reconstruct the puzzle of ancient life. And Dr. Phillips highlights this by discussing the work of Sir Flinders Petrie, the archaeologist who pioneered the study of ceramic typology.
Ceramic typology? That sounds pretty technical.
It sounds fancy, but it's essentially the study of pottery styles and how they change over time. Petrie realized that by carefully analyzing the shapes, decorations, and manufacturing techniques of pottery, he could create a chronological framework for dating archaeological layers.
Ah, so it's like using pottery as a time machine.
You got it. And Dr. Phillips gives some great examples of how this works. She shows us everything from the simple, utilitarian oil lamps of the late Bronze Age to the more elaborate, decorated lamps of the Roman period.
So just by looking at the design of a lamp, archaeologists can tell roughly when it was made and what cultural influences might have shaped its style.
Precisely. And it's not just lamps. She talks about storage jars, cooking pots, bowls, and all sorts of other pottery forms that reveal the diversity and ingenuity of ancient Israelite culture.
It's amazing how something as seemingly mundane as pottery can unlock so much information about the past. It's like each shard is whispering secrets from a long-gone era.
It really is. And these whispers, when pieced together, can help us create a richer, more nuanced understanding of ancient Israel, not just its kings and queens, but the everyday lives of its people.
It's like we're zooming in on the human element of history, getting a feel for what life was really like for the people who lived in these ancient cities and villages. But as fascinating as their everyday lives are, I have to admit, I'm also drawn to the more mysterious aspects of their culture, their beliefs, their rituals, their spirituality. Is that something Dr. Phillips touches on in her lecture?
She does. In fact, she dedicates a significant portion of her lecture to exploring the spiritual lives of the ancient Israelites, and it's one of the most captivating parts of her presentation.
Okay, I'm officially intrigued. Give us a preview. What can we expect when we dive into this part of her lecture?
Well, she starts by acknowledging that reconstructing the religious beliefs and practices of any ancient culture, especially one as long gone as ancient Israel, is a challenging task. We don't have access to their innermost thoughts or the full spectrum of their rituals and ceremonies.
Right. We only have these tantalizing fragments, these archaeological clues that hint at their spiritual world.
Exactly. But as Dr. Phillips points out, even those fragments, when carefully analyzed and interpreted, can reveal a great deal about how ancient Israelites conceived of the divine, how they interacted with the spiritual realm, and how their beliefs shaped their everyday lives.
It's like we're trying to decode the language of faith, using archaeology as our Rosetta Stone. But where do we even begin? What are some of the key pieces of evidence that Dr. Phillips presents?
One of the most prominent and intriguing features of the ancient Israelite landscape is the abundance of standing stones, or masbof.
Ah, yes, those mysterious monoliths that have sparked countless theories and interpretations.
Exactly. These large upright stones, often found in groups or alignments, are scattered throughout the region, and they've been a source of fascination and debate for archaeologists and biblical scholars alike.
I've heard some believe they marked sacred spaces, while others think they were used in fertility rituals or as memorials to ancestors.
You're right. There's a wide range of interpretations. Some scholars even connect them to astronomical observations or ancient calendars. And Dr. Phillips doesn't shy away from these debates. She presents various viewpoints, highlighting the evidence supporting each interpretation while acknowledging the inherent ambiguity surrounding these enigmatic structures.
So it's like a giant puzzle, with each standing stone representing a potential clue to the beliefs and practices of ancient Israelites. What are some of the specific examples that Dr. Phillips highlights?
Well, she shows us examples of standing stones from various sites, including Gezer, a prominent Canaanite city-state during the Bronze Age, and Hazor, another important city that played a key role in biblical history. She also discusses the standing stones found at Shechem, a site associated with the patriarch Jacob and his family.
Ah, I remember that striking photo of the massive row of standing stones at Gezer. They're truly awe-inspiring, even in their ruined state. It's hard to imagine the kind of rituals or ceremonies that might have taken place in their presence.
They really do evoke a sense of mystery and wonder, don't they? They remind us that we're only glimpsing a fragment of a much larger and more complex spiritual world, a world that we may never fully understand.
It's like we're standing on the threshold of a lost world, trying to glimpse into the minds and hearts of those who came before us. But even if we can't fully grasp the meaning of these ancient rituals, their presence speaks volumes about the human need for connection with the divine, for something beyond the material world.
Absolutely. It's a universal longing that transcends time and culture. And these standing stones stand as silent witnesses to that longing, to that inherent human desire to reach beyond ourselves and connect with something greater.
It's a reminder that we're part of a much larger story, a story that stretches back through millennia and connects us to generations past. And it's exciting to think about all the other mysteries that are still waiting to be unearthed, all the clues that might shed further light on the spiritual lives of ancient Israelites.
You're absolutely right. And as we delve deeper into Dr. Phillips's lecture, we'll encounter more of these tangible expressions of faith, from altars and temples to figurines and amulets, each offering its own unique insights into the beliefs and practices of this ancient culture.
Okay, I'm officially hooked. Lead the way. I'm ready to dive deeper into this fascinating world of ancient spirituality and uncover more of those tantalizing clues. So we've journeyed through ancient tells, marveled at their ingenious water systems, and even decoded pottery shards. It's amazing how much we can learn about ancient Israel from these tangible pieces of the past.
It's truly remarkable. These objects transport us back in time and connect us to the lives of those who came before us.
But remember those hot topics we mentioned earlier, the ones that still spark debates amongst archaeologists today.
You mean the ones about the more controversial aspects of ancient Israelite religion?
Exactly. Dr. Phillips doesn't shy away from those practices. The ones that might seem a bit strange or even disturbing to us today. Like, for instance, she talks about the archaeological evidence of child sacrifice.
It's a difficult topic to grapple with, but it's important to acknowledge. These practices existed in many ancient cultures, including those surrounding ancient Israel.
Yeah, it's definitely a stark reminder of how different things were back then, how different their values and beliefs were.
Absolutely. And while we might find those practices abhorrent today, it's important to avoid imposing our own modern values and judgments on the past.
Right. It's about understanding them within their own cultural context. But Dr. Phillips also pointed out that the Bible itself condemns child sacrifice, right?
You're absolutely right. The biblical text portrays it as a pagan practice that was completely against the worship of Yahweh, the God of Israel.
So even within ancient Israel, there were diverse views and practices, right?
Precisely. And archaeology helps us understand those complexities, revealing the diversity of beliefs and practices that coexisted within ancient Israelite society.
It reminds us that history is rarely black and white. It's more like shades of gray.
Exactly. Reflecting the complexities of human behavior and the evolution of cultural norms.
Well said. Now, speaking of shades of gray, we also talked about historical minimalism and their skepticism towards the biblical narrative, especially those grand accounts of David and Solomon. But didn't Dr. Phillips mention that they extend their skepticism beyond just those two figures?
Yes, she does. They actually question the historicity of the entire biblical narrative, suggesting that much of it was invented during the Persian period, centuries after the events supposedly took place.
Wow, that's a pretty bold claim. So they're basically saying that the Bible is more like a work of fiction than a reliable historical document.
Well, that's a simplification of their argument, but essentially they believe that the Bible should be viewed primarily as a product of its time, reflecting the political and ideological agendas of the Persian period, rather than an accurate record of events from centuries earlier.
But we've already seen that archaeological evidence often contradicts this view, right? Like with the Tel Dan inscription, which mentions the House of David.
Exactly. And there's more evidence to support that. Remember how the minimalists argue that Jerusalem was a relatively insignificant settlement during the 10th century BCE, the time of David and Solomon?
Right, but we also talked about how Dr. Phillips counters that argument with the Amarna letters, which mention Jerusalem as a prominent city during that same time period.
Precisely. It suggests that the biblical account of Jerusalem as a major center isn't just some made-up story.
Okay, so Jerusalem wasn't just some tiny village back then. What other evidence challenges the minimalist viewpoint?
Well, Dr. Phillips also highlights the discovery of a monumental structure in the city of David. It dates back to the 10th century BCE and is believed to have been part of David's palace complex.
Hold on. So not only was Jerusalem a significant city, it also housed a grand royal structure during David's reign.
It seems so. And then there's the discovery of Kirbet Kayafa, that large fortified city southwest of Jerusalem. Remember that one?
Ah, yes. That's the site with the massive wall and two gates. And if I remember correctly, it dates back to around 1000 BCE, right? Which means it was built during David's time.
You got it. And its location and the scale of its fortifications really point to a significant centralized government, potentially challenging the minimalist claim of a weak and decentralized kingdom during David's time.
It's like all this evidence is piling up against the minimalists, and they're just ignoring it.
Well, it's important to remember that they have their own interpretations of this evidence. And while we might disagree with their conclusions, it's crucial to engage with their arguments and understand their perspective. Archaeology is a field of interpretation, and there's always room for debate and discussion.
That's a good point. It's not about proving one side right or wrong. It's about piecing together the evidence and trying to understand the past as best we can.
Exactly. And as we gather more evidence, our understanding will continue to evolve.
Well, speaking of fascinating discoveries, Dr. Phillips also talks about ancient inscriptions. Those are like little windows into the minds and lives of people from long ago.
They really are. They provide us with firsthand accounts, personal stories, and even glimpses into the thoughts and feelings of those who lived centuries ago.
Like hearing their voices echo across the millennia. And we've already talked about the Tel Dan inscription and its impact on the debate about David and Solomon, but Dr. Phillips highlights other intriguing inscriptions as well.
Well, she does. One that stands out is the inscription mentioning Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor who presided over the trial of Jesus.
Wait, seriously, we have an inscription that directly connects to a key figure in the New Testament.
Yes. This inscription, found at Caesarea Maritima, commemorates Pilate's construction of a Tiberium, a public building dedicated to the emperor Tiberius.
That's incredible. It's like a tangible link between archaeology and the biblical narrative. It's bringing the story to life in a whole new way.
It is. And it reminds us that the events described in the Bible unfolded within a specific historical context. A world of Roman governors, emperors, and grand public works.
It's like we're peeling back the layers of history to reveal the world in which Jesus lived and ministered. It's fascinating and humbling at the same time.
Absolutely. It gives us a deeper appreciation for the complexity and richness of the biblical world. And it challenges us to see those stories, not as abstract myths or legends, but as events that unfolded within a real historical context.
Okay, that's one inscription that connects us to the New Testament world. Are there any others that Dr. Phillips discusses?
She does. She mentions an inscription found at the site of Magdala, a town on the Sea of Galilee that's believed to have been the hometown of Mary Magdalene.
Oh, wow. So we have an inscription that potentially connects us to one of the most prominent women in the New Testament.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
This inscription, found on a stone block that was likely part of a synagogue, depicts a seven-branched menorah, a symbol that's deeply associated with Judaism.
So it provides further evidence of a Jewish presence in Magdala during the time of Jesus.
Exactly. And it adds another layer of historical context to the stories of the New Testament.
It's incredible to think that these inscriptions, these fragments of stone, can bridge the gap between centuries and connect us to the world of the Bible in such a tangible way.
They truly are remarkable. And as we continue to explore and excavate, who knows what other treasures we might uncover? What other voices from the past might speak to us through these ancient inscriptions?
It's exciting to think about all the possibilities, but, you know, as we're talking about this, I'm also struck by how much ground Dr. Phillips covers in her lecture. We've gone from deciphering pottery to pondering child sacrifice to exploring Roman inscriptions. It's like we've crammed a semester's worth of archaeology into a single deep dive.
You're not wrong, but that's what makes this deep dive so rewarding. It's like a crash course in the archaeology of ancient Israel.
It's definitely sparked my curiosity to learn more. I'm already thinking about which rabbit holes I want to go down next. What about you? What are some key takeaways that you'd like to leave our listener with?
Well, first and foremost, I want to emphasize that while archaeology is a powerful tool for understanding the past, it's not a magic bullet. It's an ongoing process of discovery, interpretation, and debate. And as new evidence emerges, our understanding of the past continues to evolve.
It's like a constantly shifting landscape with new vistas opening up as we explore further.
Exactly. And another key takeaway is the importance of approaching the past with humility and an open mind. We need to be willing to question our assumptions, consider different perspectives, and embrace the complexities and ambiguities of history.
I love that. It's a reminder that there's always more to learn, more to uncover, and more to understand about ourselves and our history. And speaking of uncovering, shall we continue our exploration of Dr. Phillips' lecture? There's still so much more to discover.
Absolutely. Let's delve into the final part of our deep dive.
Okay, so we've journeyed through those ancient cities and marveled at their incredible water systems. We've deciphered those mysterious inscriptions and even pondered those thought-provoking hot topics in archaeology.
We've certainly covered a lot of ground.
We have. It's amazing how archaeology can make the biblical world come to life before our eyes. But there's still so much more to uncover. What other fascinating insights does Dr. Phillips have for us?
Well, in this final part of her lecture, she shifts our focus to burial practices in ancient Israel.
Burial practices? I guess I always assumed that ancient burials were pretty straightforward. You know, you wrap the body and bury it. But I have a feeling it's not that simple.
You're right. It's not that simple at all. In fact, Dr. Phillips highlights a variety of different burial customs that were practiced in ancient Israel. And these customs reflect a range of beliefs about the afterlife and the importance of honoring the dead.
So not just one size fits all when it comes to ancient burials.
Exactly. And it's fascinating to see how these practices evolved over time and were influenced by different cultures.
Okay, give us some examples. What kind of variations are we talking about?
Well, she shows us everything from simple pit graves, which are basically just holes dug in the ground, to elaborate tombs, often carved into rock cliffs or hillsides. She also discusses different types of burial containers, including clay coffins, wooden sarcophagi, and even ossuaries.
Ossuaries. Those are those bone boxes, right?
Yeah.
The ones that were often decorated with intricate carvings.
You got it. Ossuaries became common during the Second Temple period, and they reflect a belief in the importance of preserving the remains of the deceased. After the body decomposed, the bones were collected and placed in these ossuaries, and then the ossuaries were stored in family tombs.
It's a very different way of thinking about death and the afterlife than what we're used to today. But those ossuaries are more than just containers, right? They can actually tell us a lot about the people themselves.
Absolutely. They often have inscriptions or decorations that provide valuable insights into family relationships, social status, and even religious beliefs. It's amazing how much information we can glean from the way people treated their dead.
It makes you realize that death wasn't simply the end. There were rituals and beliefs that shaped how people approached it. And archaeology helps us uncover those layers of meaning.
Exactly. And it's not just the objects themselves. It's also the context in which they're found. Mm-hmm. The location of the burial, the orientation of the body, the types of grave goods that are included. All of these factors contribute to our understanding of ancient burial practices.
It's like archaeology is giving us a glimpse into the spiritual world of ancient Israel, a world that's both familiar and foreign to us.
It is, and it's a world that continues to fascinate and challenge our understanding of the past.
Mm.
But, you know, we've talked a lot about the ancient Israelites, but it's important to remember that by the time of Jesus, Israel was under Roman rule.
Right. And we see that Roman influence reflected in the New Testament as well.
Absolutely. And Dr. Phillips doesn't shy away from this aspect of history. In fact, she highlights several ways in which Roman culture impacted the lives of the people living in Israel during the first century CE.
So in a way, we're seeing the world of the New Testament come into sharper focus.
Precisely. She talks about things like Roman architectural projects, like the construction of theaters, aqueducts, and even entire cities.
Like Caesarea Maritima, that impressive port city built by Herod the Great.
Exactly. And she also points out how Roman goods and technologies like pottery, coins, and even weapons became increasingly common in Israel during this period.
It's like we're seeing those Roman influences seep into the fabric of everyday life. It's a reminder that the world of the New Testament was incredibly diverse and dynamic, a true melting pot of cultures and influences.
It was. And archaeology helps us to appreciate that diversity and complexity. It challenges us to see the biblical world not as a static backdrop, but as a vibrant and ever-changing landscape shaped by a myriad of historical forces.
It's amazing. I feel like I've gained a whole new perspective on the Bible and its historical context. I can't believe how much we've covered in this deep dive.
Me neither. We've journeyed through ancient cities, marveled at ingenious water systems, deciphered mysterious inscriptions, pondered those challenging hot topics, and even delved into the spiritual world of ancient Israel, exploring their burial practices and the impact of Roman culture. It's been quite an adventure.
It has. And I want to thank you for joining us on this journey. And to our listeners, we encourage you to keep exploring, keep digging into those fascinating topics that have piqued your interest, and never stop seeking knowledge and understanding.
Well said. And who knows what other amazing discoveries await us just beneath the surface.
That's the beauty of archaeology. It's a constant journey of discovery. And until our next deep dive, keep those archaeological adventures going.